Brent Manning joins me this week to talk about craft malting. This is Beersmith Podcast number 244.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 244, and it's early October 2021. Brent Manning joins me this week to talk about craft malting. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also The Brew Commander, the new brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with a new Brew Commander. To order yours today, go to BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I'm happy to say the web-based version of Beersmith is available now at BeersmithRecipes.com. Beersmith for the Web lets you brew, edit, and create recipes from any browser, including your desktop, tablet, or mobile device. The new web version gives you access to tens of thousands of recipes, online recipe editing, advanced water tools, and much more. You can try Beersmith Web for 30 days by setting up an account at beersmithrecipes.com. If you purchase a Gold, Platinum, or Pro license, you get both Beersmith Web and the desktop version for one low price. Check out beersmithrecipes.com now to give Beersmith Web a try. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome Brent Manning. Brent spent a decade as an environmental consultant before co-founding Riverbend Malt House in North Carolina 10 years ago. Brent is also a certified Cicerone. Brent, it's great to have you on the show. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing fine. Thank you so much for having me. This is really fun. I've been a Beersmith user since my early homebrewing days, so this is pretty special.
That's awesome. And you guys are also celebrating your 10th anniversary as a malt house, which is pretty exciting. I think when you started, there weren't very many malt houses around, right?
Yeah, the craft malt houses, you know, there was probably three or four of us spread throughout North America. And you know, it was a really exciting time. You know, there wasn't much on the internet to help guide us. So we were all kind of making our way, working with our own various skill sets and sharing information when we could. So it was fun. Now we're now there's well over 60 craft malt houses in North America.
That's awesome. Well, I wanted you to tell me first, we'll talk about the anniversary and a number of other things, but I wanted to first tell me, you know, what motivated you to launch a malt house way back in 2011?
Yeah, so my co-founder, Brian Simpson, and I were just big fans of craft beer. We moved our families from Wilmington on the coast of North Carolina to Asheville. And, you know, just quickly started looking around and realized, you know, Asheville was kind of a bring your own job economy. And we saw craft beer spooling up. And we said to ourselves, well, we want to be a part of this and we want to do something very sustainably focused. So I don't want to be the 13th brewery, but what can we do that can kind of connect maybe local agriculture to this burgeoning craft beer movement? And the answer was not hops. We're still working to build a hop industry in the Southeast, but small grains was much more established, and it was easier to find contract growers that could help us sort of dip our toes in the water to get things started with a small-scale craft malt house.
And did either one of you actually know anything about malting back then?
No, not a bit. Like I say, I was a home brewer, and you know, I knew Maris Otter, and I knew some of the other major maltsters around the world that I had brewed with their material, and knew some of the basics, but had never done any home malting or anything like that when we first kicked this idea off.
So how did you actually go about learning the craft and building the equipment? I think at the time there wasn't a lot of commercial equipment available, right?
There was basically no commercial equipment. So much as in the early days of breweries, we leaned into the dairy tank world and things like that to get started. But Brian and I actually had even more humble beginnings. We have what we call the Maltitron 5000, and that was a modified meat smoker from Sam's that we duct taped a bathroom fan to do some of our first 10-pound test batches. We were meeting with the agricultural extension folks from NC State, and they were doing some barley variety trials, and they sent us home with some of those barley varieties to play with, essentially, in Brian's basement. And so he would run through the steeping, germinating, and kilning and bring me 10 pounds of malt to turn into craft beer a week later. And so those were the humble beginnings of local malt in the Southeast.
And if I recall, you started, you did try and get some kind of formal education too, right?
Didn't yeah, you? Absolutely. So once we were, you know, a couple of things, we kind of, you know, a couple of those light bulb moments kind of happened. We were able to secure some funding to build the first malt house. And part of that funding we earmarked to go to the Canadian Malting Barley Technical Center's first ever malt academy course. So So we looked all over the world for somebody to teach us how to make malt professionally. Brian and I both have master's degrees in scientific fields, so we were very focused on education. We were not going to hack at this. We really wanted to understand the science behind what was going on. And so the folks up in Canada were kind enough to take in two Southerners and hold our hands for a month. Teaching us, it's an amazing facility in Winnipeg. So they had test malting equipment, they had seed cleaning equipment, they had a brewery in the basement. This was one of our first interactions with the terroir of barley. Just really fascinating time up there. So we came back with it was literally one professor and Brian and I. And so it was a 2-to-1 back student to teacher ratio, and wow. A great opportunity to learn. And
I've been to Winnipeg a couple of times. I had no idea they had malting up there.
You wouldn't know it to look at it. So this building was part of the Canadian Grain Commission, and so they do a lot of QAQC work for all the exports that go out of Canada. And so it's in basically a skyscraper in downtown Winnipeg that they have all this really interesting equipment in. And so we had an absolute ball, came back and built out our whopping 2,000 square foot malt house and produced our first batch in November of 2011. So it's got started, like I say, we were 2,000 square feet, 1-ton batches using modified dairy equipment, and our first kiln was built from old refrigerator panels cooler panels from a Winn-Dixie butcher shop.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. What are this? You mentioned you started doing 1-ton batches, which are not really that large. What kind of a system did you put together? And I mean, were you floor malting? How were you doing all this?
Yeah. So we took over a small space that was basically a grocery supply place in a previous life. And so the one little room was insulated, and that's where we did two small, pieces of malt, floor malted exclusively at that point, shoveled into a wheelbarrow and then driven up a ramp and dumped into the kiln, which was, like I say, probably 8x8 in dimension, something like that. But yeah, custom fabricated all the way through. Needless to say, the people at the Asheville Building Commission had a lot of questions about what we were doing. When you say words like kilning, they immediately think pottery and 500 degree temperatures. And so we kind of had to do some delicate education around, you know, here's the temperature range, here are the equipment that we're using to heat.
Probably should have said air drying or something like that instead.
Right, exactly. You know, there's always a hindsight there, but we were able to get going, and working with locally grown barley was brand new and unique at the time, and so we had a lot of education in those early days. You know, we were working exclusively with six row barley varieties as well, a variety called Thoroughbred. And I'll admit, you know, as a home brewer, I still remember a paragraph in Charlie Papazian's book, you know, where he's like, oh, six row, you can expect to have higher protein and this, you know, a couple other negative aspects of working with it. And I wish that had never been written, because we spent years undoing that sort of baked in knowledge. Yeah.
Well, what was your response? What was the response to the first few batches of craft malt that you actually put out?
You know, I think people were really excited. They were, I don't think a lot of them knew that it was even possible to grow barley in the Southeast that could be malted and then turned into craft beer. And, you know, I always kind of draw the connecting line between, you know, we were kind of like the farmer's market of malt, in the sense that, you know, we knew who our farmers were and we knew how far away they were. And there was a traceability aspect that, quite frankly, brewers just weren't used to being privy to. And so a lot of excitement around that aspect and the artisan nature of how it was being made. You know, even your educated listeners might not realize, you know, when we talk about making malt at large scale, you know, it's 200, 300, 400, 500 ton batches. And here we are, you know, one ton batches on the floor. You know, the folks up in Canada at CBTC definitely thought we were crazy. You know, they're like, I don't understand what these guys are doing with a one ton malt house. This is bananas.
I mean, that's about like a cubic yard of malt or something like that, right? It's not huge.
Yeah. You know, I would say that one ton on the floor would occupy 500-600 square feet, something like that. Yeah. It was pretty tiny. But you know, we had to start somewhere. We needed proof of concept. You know, were people really interested in this? And you know, were they willing to talk about it on their labels? You know, where was this all going to go?
Could you do just for a minute or so, maybe explain the basic malting process? Because I know a lot of listeners have probably heard it before, but it is interesting to hear how you take raw barley and actually turn it into malt.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we talk about making malt, you know, three main steps: steeping, germinating, and kilning. And they take place over the period of about 7 to 8 days. In the early days, barley germinated very, very slowly. And so that malting process might be 15 to 16 days. So a lot of modern breeding was focused on shortening that germination time. But anyway, the goal is basically to manage the enzymatic digestion of the cell walls as they're converted into starches and simple sugars. So we do that by essentially tricking the grain into growing. So we'll steep it. It'll go through three wet, dry cycles. We typically walk that moisture up from about 12% where the grain is harvested to between 44 and 46%. Mm-hmm. At that point, the grain will chit out. It kind of looks like a little pimple.
Starts growing, right?
Yep, exactly. And from that point, we need to get it out of the steep tank, spread it out onto the floor, and allow the germination process to take place over a 3 to 5 day period. So, and this is really where the maltster's art starts to come in, is, you know, we have a limited portfolio of raw grains that we work with, but we can make, you know, well over a dozen products, and even without a roaster. And so we start modulating this germination stage. You know, if we're looking for a Pilsner style malt as a finished product, we want that to be slightly under modified. So we might go 3.5 days on the floor. It's going to taste more, you know, cucumbery, some say, well, like a peanutty kind of a flavor, but definitely fresh cut grass as a dominating characteristic. And we'll couple that with a cooler temperature regime, so it doesn't become overly sweet and bready. For something like a pale ale style malt, we'll go 4, 4.5 days. We want it to be fully modified. And when I say modified, I mean as much of the cell wall material broken down as possible, so that we're elevating extract as much as we can, breaking down beta glucans, and setting the table for building bready, sweet flavors with a higher kilning temperatures throughout that final stage. For a Munich malt, we'll take that even further, maybe 5, 5.5 days, something like that. Really develop a lot of soluble protein that we can convert into a wide range of flavors with even warmer temperatures in the kiln. Mm-hmm. So kilning takes about 24 hours to dry the grain down. What we want to do is basically halt that modification process and not kill any enzymes. So this is a delicate dance of drying, three main steps, free dry, forced dry, and curing. Temperatures will go anywhere from 120 in the cool dry stage, free dry stage. And if we're doing Pilsners, we'll be between, you know, 170s and 180s. Munichs could be upwards of 240 Fahrenheit. So all of those dynamics are at play when a maltster is producing their product line. And so it's definitely a mix of art and science that's a lot of fun to play around with.
And then talk about the raw materials. I know you started with a local six-row barley, right? But are you primarily sourcing local barleys or are you using barleys from outside?
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, our stock and trade since we started has been, you know, 100% of our grain from the Southeast. And so early on, we were working with exclusively thoroughbred six-row barley as a variety that Virginia Tech released. Starting about 2017, 2018, private breeders like Lima Grain brought two-row varieties into the conversation. So now we're working with Calypso, Violetta, Flavia. So there's several different two-row varieties available right now. And then on, you know, we're using soft red winter wheat, an heirloom rye called Renzabruzzi, non-GMO corn, hulled and hullless oat. You know, we've even gotten rye to grow as far south as Tampa, Florida. So there's a really... I always tell people, you know, we kind of have 1 foot in the past, 1 foot in the future. So we're always sort of working with exploring, you know, what varieties we can bring back to the South, but then also looking to both public and private grain breeder or barley breeders to see kind of what's next.
I know for a long time, just a handful of varieties really dominated all of the brewing. Is that still true today? Or are we starting to see introduction of, you know, more craft style varieties or even heirloom varieties?
You know, heirlooms are tough because of the yield issues and disease pressure. Yeah. And, you know, climate change is definitely wreaking a lot of havoc on trying to bring those varieties back. But, you know, out west, you know, and I should clarify one other point. So when we're talking about southern grown grain, we're actually talking about winter barley. So barley that's planted in mid to late October and harvested in June. So that's different than most of the barley that grows in Canada and out west, where it would be a spring barley. So planted in May, harvested late July, early August before that first frost comes out. So it's two different pools of varieties that we're working with. But you're exactly right. A very limited number of spring two-row varieties dominate the malting industry out west. They're not available to us, and we work exclusively with the winter barleys.
The winter ones, yeah.
Yep.
Interesting.
Now, from a spec sheet analysis, you know, I'm excited to tell you that they're almost identical. You can't tell anything on a C of A that tells you, oh, this is Calypso, or oh, this is Copeland, or this is Maris Otter or Pearl or whatever. You know, if the maltster knows what he or she is doing, you shouldn't be able to tell.
Interesting. Well, let's see. Within about 2 years, you secured funding for the Malt House 2. So I think that would be around 2013. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. So the obviously we had nowhere to go with up, right? We had one ton batches. So, you know, the great thing, timing is everything, right? So, you know, right about the time we started spooling up, Asheville started adding breweries. And the South Slope area, south of downtown, started to develop as a brewing district. And we started to see more and more interest around what we were doing. New Belgium also announced their intention to move to Western North Carolina, as did Sierra Nevada and Oscar Blues. So, I mean, it was it was an unbelievable time just with that amount of energy in the space. And so, you know, with support from both the guys in the South Slope and some of the larger folks that were coming into town, you know, it was very easy to build a compelling case that we needed to grow our business. And so thankfully, there was a space in the same complex right next door, 10,000 square feet, that we stepped into and went from 1-ton batches to 4-ton batches. So a really nice leap in production capability, and opened in early 2014 and just continued to build the business over the next couple of years. So it was really exciting times. You know, a lot, like I say, a lot of great energy in the space. Our growers were getting more experienced at growing better quality barley, so our specs were improving, and just a lot of wind at our back during that period.
So talk to us about Malt House 2 and what it actually, you know, obviously I think you're working with a different system at this point, right?
Still floor malted, just more.
Still floor malted, okay.
Yeah. So we got bigger batches, and man, I'm here to tell you, raking 4 tons of barley 3 times a day, it will help build some muscle, and it's especially if you're raking 4 tons of rye. It was a bit of a rite of passage that some, you know, so when you pull the rake, you're actually kind of walking backwards, and you know, rye doesn't have a husk, and so it's really slippery and mushy, and it's a pain in the butt to work with. And you know, it's kind of a rite of passage to kind of slip and bust your face pulling the rake through that stuff. And you know, it was a wild ride. You know, I mean, we were maxing that Malt House 2.0 out within probably 24 months of swinging the doors open there. So we were just like, wow, this is really going fast, you know, and people are loving what we're doing. You know, this was right when the other sort of positive trend we had was the mixed culture beer movement at this time, you know, sour wild ales and, you know, wood age stuff. You know, everyone was looking for this rustic character malt. You know, they wanted something that was, you know, represented their place in the universe. And Riverbend's product line was perfect for those beers. And so we had a lot of, you know, support from folks that were exploring that space during that time.
And you certainly mentioned several times the craft brewing explosion that took place at the same time in Asheville. But how has your relationship sort of evolved over the years with some of these smaller craft breweries?
You know, it's really been a lot of fun. It's become very much a collaborative conversation about, you know, what kind of beer are you putting together next week, you know, or what's your spring seasonal, you know, or, hey, Brent, what are you working on? You know, tell me something that you see kind of in the R&D pipeline and let me hold a slot for that, you know? So, for example, you know, recently we worked on a product called Munich Rye, and you know, basically just a really nice warm kilning recipe to our classic Carolina Rye product, building the SRM up to around 12 to 14. And you know, it just happened to be having a conversation with the guys at Highwire about it, and next thing I know, Munich Rye Lager is coming out in 16-ounce cans, and it's one of my favorite beers of the year that comes out, you know. So just having that sort of open dialogue, I think, has been really special, you know, kind of a peer-to-peer conversation.
And I think you also expanded into craft distilling as well, right? You started working with some distillers at some point?
Absolutely, yeah. So this is, you know, craft distilling is following on the heels of craft beer in terms of growth potential, just lagging several years behind. And you know, much in the same way that a craft brewer would be interested in you know, a distinctive, really flavorful product for a special beer, distillers look at it the very same way. Like, you know, I kind of have my normal recipe here, but when I do something special, I want to pull in Riverbend's heirloom rye, or I want, you know, a really rich Munich or Vienna style product to really give some interesting complexity to this whiskey. And so that's been really fun. I don't know near as much about the distillation process and science as I do about brewing. So I'm I'm very much a try to be a sponge whenever we chat with those folks.
Well, somewhere around 2017, you started planning for Malt House 3, yet another expansion. Can you tell us about that? Are we still floor malting at this point?
Still a little bit, but we did step into pneumatic malting at this point. So we have what's called GKVs, germ kiln vessels.
Yeah. So what's the difference? What's pneumatic malting, I guess?
Yeah. So basically, you know, think about the vessel. So when we kiln grain, we kiln typically it's about a meter deep. Mm-hmm. And when we floor malt, the grain is about 6 inches deep, maybe 4 to 6 inches, something like that. So when we talk about making malt in a germ kiln vessel, the malt or the malt is loaded in from the steep tank at a meter deep and turned by augers instead of human hands during the germination stage. And because it's piled on top of itself, we need a tremendous amount of cool, humid air to be circulating during germination. And so it's two very different HVAC systems that are managing the piece in between the germination stage where we want it cool and humid, and then the kilning stage where we want it dry and warm. And so understanding the dynamics of making great malt in that system versus floor malting was quite the leap. As Joe Hertrich says, the collisions are far more spectacular when you operate with a GKV system.
And I said, the GKV system is probably doing it all in one vessel, right?
Right. So, Well, the steep tank is separate, and then we do a wet transfer slurry into the GKVs, each piece lives in the GKV for the duration of germination and kilning.
Right.
So, during that time, we're just pulling samples and judging moisture content and modification rates, but not turning it by hand as we do on the floor. We still have a floor malt system that runs a couple of 2-ton batches at a time, and that serves as our R&D and special projects system.
So it's kind of your pilot system then, huh?
It is. Yeah. Yep, exactly. And so it's well designed in the sense that the 2-ton kiln, you know, per ton basis has the same amount of airflow and BTUs available as the 10-ton system does. So if I come up with a cool recipe for something at the 2-ton level, we can immediately scale it up to a 10-ton batch and produce it at scale. So it's a really fun malt house to work with in that sense, you know, that we've got a functional pilot system that makes enough malt for, you know, most of our, you know, obviously not Sierra Nevada and New Belgium, but most of our folks in the South Slope can take one of these pilot batches, brew with it, and give us good technical feedback in short order.
Right. So you almost have you have a pilot brewery too, right?
yeah.
Available, you know, anyway.
Yeah, we've gotten to know a lot of these guys pretty well. So I can, you know, do a little sample bag with write it in Sharpie and leave it on someone's front desk or leave it in their office. And they're like, oh, what the hell did Brent leave for me? Oh, what is this? You know, I have no idea. But it was a big leap. You know, we were in 10,000 square feet. We brought on a CEO named Scott Hickman, who was instrumental in helping us raise money to go into a 70,000 square foot facility where all of this beautiful stainless steel now lives. And it's quite a ride. I mean, to make that leap. And, you know, when we left Malt House 2.0, we were around 700-ish thousand pounds a year, and we're closing in on 3 million now. So
that's a serious number there.
Yeah. It's wild. I mean, our staff is fantastic. They do an awesome job at helping us produce high quality craft malt at that volume. So it still kind of makes me, it still catches me by surprise some days when I walk in and see this giant concrete fortress full of malting equipment and raw barley.
Now, in the notes you sent me before the show, you mentioned you guys started out malting, I think we said 6-row thoroughbred barley, but you've actually been doing some research into 2-row barley. And can you talk a little bit about, I think you do some research with different entities as well, right?
Yeah. So this has been really fun as well. You know, both Virginia Tech and NC State have breeding programs at the public level. And they're part of a larger network throughout the Southeast that actually does variety trial work across a lot of these states. And so, you know, I always joke that we still don't have a number for flavor, which is we're working on, you know. But what we do have the ability to do small scale malting, to give the researchers some feedback with regards to the flavors that we're picking up, and you know, working with folks at Hartwick College and Montana State, they do barley testing for us, both raw barley and finished malt testing. And so we're able to have this really interesting dynamic conversation about, you know, crop year variability and malting, you know, statistic, you know, from, you know, here's what a brewer expects, here's what I'm tasting on the flavor side of things. And it's been really fun because, you know, when a barley breeder crosses two different varieties, they don't know exactly what they're going to get, but they get tons of different offspring. And then these are field trialed over 8-10 years to develop what they call the elite lines. And these elite lines are really where the maltster gets to kind of step in and give his or her two cents as to what we think about them.
I'm thinking about a process maybe analogous to developing a new hop, which takes like 15 years, right? So I assume something similar is going on the malt side, right?
Very much so. You know, it takes a long time to see what works. And then, you know, thankfully, we're about to see, you know, some of the fruits of labor from Virginia Tech and NC State in the coming years as they release their first, what I guess I'll call Southern Born and Bred two-row barleys. So this is going to be fun. This is the next chapter. You know, while I'm really excited to have Calypso and Violetta available to us and Flavia, you know, they actually work over a fairly large geographic area. I was talking with a buddy in Michigan the other day, and, you know, they're playing around with Violetta up there. And, you know, not that I want something to be called my very own and own it outright, but, you know, the more that we can differentiate the Southeast from the rest of the U.S. and the rest of the planet in terms of the varieties that we have available to us, I think that's a win for our breweries and distilleries in the area.
And before the show, you mentioned that there's also been a big push into craft lagers and that has affected some of your malting operations. You want to talk a little bit about craft lagers and the things you've been doing there?
Yes. Definitely. So, you know, I as many who know me, I'm not a huge fan of hazy IPAs. You know, my old home brewing roots, if I'd brought a hazy beer into the homebrew club, they would have run me out of there 15 years ago, you know. But, you know, when the hazy beers hit the streets, we developed malted oats as a way of, you know, putting a craft malt option in front of folks who were focused on those styles. And, you know, with craft lagers, it's very much the same thing. You know, we're looking and developing that terroir of Southern barley, you know, by exploring a state by state comparison. So, you know, malting only Violetta from Virginia and malting only Calypso from Tennessee as a Pilsner style product, you know, like playing around with those, like single origin, kind of think about it like coffee almost, that we're getting to that level. And then I'll provide tasting notes to a brewer who's developing a new lager. And, you know, I'll say, you know, something like, hey, this Calypso has some nice soft bread dough character. I think it'd be perfect in a Helles. Or, you know, Violetta's more floral and slightly grainier. You know, maybe that's where you want to go for that German Pilsner recipe. So we're able to really get together and nerd out on flavor, variety, and grower location, all these different things to really make something special and unique in the lager category.
You know, you've been around for a long time. The craft malting industry has changed quite a bit, and I think you wanted to say a few words about the craft malting conference coming up in 2022.
Yeah, you know, I'm president of the Craft Maltsters Guild and one of the co-founders. And so it's just been really exciting to watch this industry grow. We've got maltsters in every corner of the U.S. and Canada, and we have a steadily growing international contingent, which is really fun to see that happening. And so we look at our annual conference as a way to pull all these folks together and, you know, share the latest and greatest on best practices. I mean, this can be everything from farming to engineering on the malt house equipment side of things. We can talk about marketing. We can talk about, you know, all sorts of different information. So it's a really fun time where we get, you know, farmers, maltsters, academics, all presenting on something that they're excited about. And, you know, last year with the pandemic, we were 100% virtual, and that went off fairly well. This year, we're sort of pursuing a hybrid model. So we're going to do an in-person conference in Portland, Maine, February 18th and 19th. And then we'll follow that up with a virtual component the following weekend, the 25th and 26th. Mm. So we feel like this is a great way to, you know, get people together for networking and develop some really a nice program for those folks, but also, you know, to really support folks that are maybe still slightly uncomfortable to travel or have travel restrictions in their home nation. You know, we still have a vehicle to connect them to our community with some separate content and access to the in-person content as well. So it's going to be really fun. We're building an excellent program, and I'm excited to get back and see everybody in person. And I've never been to Portland, Maine, so that's going to be fun to visit as well.
Well, you're celebrating your 10th anniversary now. What are some of the big lessons you've learned after 10 years in the craft malting business?
Oh, man.
There's got to be a few there.
There are definitely a few. You know, what I will say is, maybe one takeaway is it's not enough to just be local. You know, we really need to deliver a high quality, consistent product that people can have a high degree of confidence in working with. You know, early on, I always kind of referred to getting stuck in the Sunday dinner mentality, you know, where we were only getting pulled into collaborations and things like that, which was great publicity, but, you know, even more satisfying to get pulled into that flagship beer because the brewer now has confidence that we can deliver larger volumes of consistent material into the door that tastes great. You know, that to me is really sort of the take home that I'm feeling after 10 years. The farmers are doing a fantastic job of delivering high quality grain. And so they help us set the table for success. And, just excited to continue to grow this movement of local grain.
Well, your malts are available to commercial brewers, but you also have them available through some homebrew shops, I believe, as well. Where can people learn more about your products or maybe even get some samples of them?
Yeah, so we've got several homebrew shops sprinkled throughout the Southeast, several of which do some mail order business and have online storefronts. Mm-hmm. We try to keep an up-to-date list of those homebrew shops on our website for those who are interested.
Yeah, I just put your website up there.
Beautiful. Yeah, so homebrewers listening can find us there. Of course, here in Asheville, we always point people to Asheville Brewers Supply. They have an online store and are able to ship smaller volumes.
Oh, I wanted to mention your website's riverbendmalt.com, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, just saying, you know, we love keeping that interface with the homebrew community alive. You know, a lot of homebrewers become pro brewers, and the feedback that we get from our homebrew community is super important, and we love interacting with them. And I've got the files up on your database now, right?
You do. I believe they're available now. Yeah, so that's great.
Beautiful. Yeah. So we can when you're building recipes at home, you've got the latest and greatest specs and the actual ingredient files to work with now. So that was fun.
Well, Brent, I wanted to get your closing thoughts on 10 years of craft malting.
Yeah. So, you know, we're just thankful to be part of the craft beer and spirits movement that's going on. And like I say, if we can play some role into helping build a Southern style of beer that we get, that the South becomes known for, I'd love to see that. You know, I think I said that 10 years ago when we started, and we still haven't, defined what Southern beer can be. So I think there's a really exciting challenge yet to be met out there.
Well, Brent, really appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, appreciate the time and the opportunity. This was a blast.
And my guest today was Brent Manning, co-founder of Riverbend Malt House, also a certified Cicerone. Brent, thank you once again.
Appreciate it.
A big thank you to Brent Manning for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also The Brew Commander, the new brew house controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brew house controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander. To order yours today, go to BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I'm happy to say the web-based version of Beersmith is available now at BeersmithRecipes.com. Beersmith for the web lets you brew, edit, and create recipes from any browser, including your desktop, tablet, or mobile device. You can try Beersmith Web for free for 30 days by setting up an account at BeersmithRecipes.com. And if you purchase a gold or higher license, you get both Beersmith Web and the desktop version of Beersmith for one low price. I go to BeersmithRecipes.com to give it a try. Again, that's BeersmithRecipes.com. I'd like to thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.